The Chinese believed in using the best of Western civilization for the progress of their country. And while they were building this new nation, just a day and a half by steamer across the Yellow Sea, lay Japan. Here, the God Emperor and his fanatic warlords were using this same Western civilization for one purpose and only one: to create one of the world's most powerful war machines. Their aim, the absorption of China and the fulfillment of the Tanaka Memorial. For years, Japan had deliberately copied military weapons and industrial techniques discovered in other countries. For years, Japan, under the pretext of lacking raw materials for industry, had been buying in every corner of the world materials not only to build this war machine, but materials which could be stored to feed it in the war of conquest they were planning. For years, while other nations were trying to outlaw war by reducing armaments, Japan was feverishly and secretly building a modern army, a modern navy, a modern air force, to strike its infamous blow at the civilized world. And we all now know about the islands in the Pacific that Japan fortified in violation of all international treaties. These were the reasons why it was possible for Japan, only 1/20th the size of China, and only 1/6th the population of China, to think of conquering China as the first step to world conquest. And as you have seen, in 1931, they embarked on phase one, the occupation of Manchuria. The small bonfire that the Japanese lit in Manchuria was to grow and spread with uncontrollable fury until the entire world was aflame. Phase one of the Tanaka plan was completed, and exactly as planned. The Japs had been confident that this first and sudden land grab could be accomplished without their becoming involved in a major war. And they were right. The unification of China was still too remote for the Chinese of the South to care what happened to their kinsmen in the North. Using the step-by-step technique, a few months later, the Japs took a crack at Shanghai. Chinese resistance was so great, they hastily called that deal off, waited another year, and then struck in the north again, carving the province of Yehol out of China proper. This, too, they got away with. The world criticized, the Chinese protested, but still the Japs got what they wanted, another piece of China, and without a war on their hands. And to rule over Manchuria and Yehol, the Japs then set up a puppet government under their stooge, Henry Puyi, the Chinese Quisling Prince. But the leaders of New China remembered that in other centuries, other barbarians had invaded their country. The evidence still stood in the Great Wall, built by their ancestors more than 2,000 years earlier, and stretching for 1,400 miles across mountain and desert to protect themselves from the barbarians of the north. Of the Great Wall, it has been said that it is the only work of man which would be visible from the moon. But the Chinese knew that modern barbarians can't be stopped by a wall, however strong or high. They can't even be stopped by people, unless the people are united. And by 1937, the unification of China was making such progress, the Japs got worried. The one weapon they could not permit China was unity. They would strike again before China could become a nation. This time it'd be a big bite. Five more northern provinces out of the heart of China. At the United States Embassy in China as military attaché for a number of years was Colonel William Mayer. Let him tell you what happened.
First thing the Japs did was to prepare their usual fake alibi. This time it wasn't a damaged railway track, as it had been in Manchuria in 1931. A Jap soldier had disappeared. Obviously, he'd been kidnapped by the insolent Chinese. Once more, Japan's honor had been insulted. Once more, the insult must be avenged. So, on the night of July 7th, 1937, at the Marco Polo Bridge near Peking, the Jap war machine struck. Within the space of a few weeks, the invaders were in control of Tientsin and Beiping. It looked as if the Japs were going to have another walkover.
Now the Japs sat back to digest and organize this new conquest. The peace-loving Japanese didn't want a war, if they could get their land grabs without one. But this time they were in for a rude surprise. This time, instead of protesting or negotiating, the Chinese struck back. And not in the north, but at Shanghai, where the Japs least expected it. To understand the fighting that followed, we must know something about the city of Shanghai itself. Situated near the mouth of the Yangtze River, it is the biggest city in China. As the largest seaport in the Far East, it dominated the commerce and foreign trade of China. And through its great docks and channels passed most of the wealth of the Orient. In Shanghai, truly the East met the West. And within this city of 3.5 million Chinese was another city, the foreign settlement, made up of the French concession and the well-known international settlement. There, the various powers, including Great Britain, the United States, and Japan, had stationed detachments of troops, Japanese, British, French, and our own United States Marines, to assist the police of the Shanghai Municipal Council in the preservation of peace and order, and to protect the boundaries of the international settlement. These detachments were limited in size, but the Japs secretly, and in violation of all treaty agreements, had increased their garrison so that when fighting started on the border of their concession in August of 1937, they thought they were fully prepared for any eventuality. Of the Chinese counterattack almost drove the Japs into the Wangpu River. Backed up by the heavy guns of their warships, however, the Japs managed to hold out until reinforcements arrived. Jap landings were then made in the vicinity of the Wusung forts and in Luho and Lotien on the Yangtze River north of Shanghai. The Chinese drew back to positions 5 or 10 miles inland, where they could secure some protection from the heavy Jap naval gunfire. At the same time, the invaders succeeded in making a surprise landing some 20 miles to the south of Shanghai, put two divisions ashore, and pushed rapidly north to outflank the city. The Chinese position was thus made untenable, and a withdrawal was ordered to the west and to the south toward Nanking and Hangzhou. But only about half of the Chinese army that had fought at Shanghai was left to withdraw. Meanwhile, enraged at the very idea of anyone resisting the Imperial Japanese might, the Japs took their vengeance upon the civilian population of the city, a city without guns or planes to defend itself, and deliberately slaughtered thousands from the air. Thank you. refuge inside the international settlement, where Japan was afraid to bomb the property and people of the foreign powers just yet. There was not room for all. For each who found safety inside, there were thousands huddled beyond the gates, standing helpless and undefended against the Jap attacks. There was no escape for these surging and panic-stricken people. They could only scurry through the narrow streets, pushing and packing themselves into the center of the city, to be trapped and buried alive in the collapse of bombed and burning buildings. Japanese introduced the world to a new kind of war.